is when things go wrong.
Brother Harry.
That was a nice connection, wasn't it? When things go wrong, Brother Harry.
You got it.
However, you all are aware of situations such as we get from time to time, where somebody rings you up and says, my wife's going to leave me. And then, what can I do? Or maybe my husband's going to leave me. What can I do? When this situation arises, then you haven't got to deal with my wife wants to leave me. The question that's got to be asked is, why does my wife want to leave me or my husband want to leave me? What is the reason for it? You sometimes, for example, you have comments like, my husband's committed adultery. What do I do? Now, you still have to ask the question, why did my husband commit adultery? Like maybe, and it was wrong so to do, but I mean, that's pretty clear, isn't it? It's wrong to do that. But the reason for it may not be just that he committed adultery, but the things have been bad at home for quite a long time. And I've told him that I'm not going to sleep with him. So he's under that kind of strain. And consequently then, there may be an explanation for what's happened. Not necessarily an excuse. There is no excuse for wanting to leave your partner. That is, you can't excuse yourself, but you may be able to explain why it is that it takes place. Now, and you are aware, as I was not aware, and Mr. Bernice was not aware, at your age, of these things taking place, because these things did not take place when we were your age. It would be an extremely unusual thing to be taking place. It would be the kind of thing where there would be whispers about it and people wouldn't be told about it. And it took place with such great infrequency that really people did not know quite how to handle it. It was regarded as a taboo subject that you didn't actually talk about it. Now, it's so common that it may have happened in your ecclesia, or certainly perhaps happened within your family circle, near or larger family circle, or with one of your friends. And so we need just to have a look at some of the things that contribute to the breakdown of marriage. In fact, you see, that is the obverse of what is it that makes a marriage good. You see, when we're married, as I mentioned earlier on, we are not given the marriage as a wedding present. We just sung about the gift from God in that hymn. But we're actually not given our marriage. We haven't got a marriage to begin with. When we are married, we start, first of all, with individuals who love one another and have decided that they wish to be together and commit themselves then to be together for good, for life. Now, but although this may not have happened with all of you, there shouldn't have been sexual relationships beforehand. And now that you are married, if you had sexual relations before, you know why you shouldn't. Because that took away the wonder of that moment. You lost it. You lost it in some furtive or other way. And then you never had it. You never had that one thing. Because you know very well it is far different when you're married than if you're not married and it's something that you do on the side. Now, I'm not pronouncing a judgment. All I'm just saying is you know by experience, and you would tell your children the right thing now. But nevertheless, when you start at the beginning, then you are constructing the marriage. And you construct it on the materials that you have got. Now, it is... our experience, by our, I mean the two of us, it is our experience that when marriage breaks down, it rarely breaks down with a snap. Very, very rarely does it break down with a snap. It may appear like that at the time, But in actual fact, there are antecedents to it, things that have gone on before or have not gone on before. The secret within marriage is communication. That's the secret. Total communication. The traffic flows both ways, and that all the time. Now, we live in a world of communication, and we're all using it all the time, and so you're probably at the office having faxes every day, or you're sending email, or you're getting this kind of pseudo-urgent stuff that our world has created and put us under pressure by, because a fax, generally speaking, is not something that's extremely urgent. It's made urgent by the fact it's faxed. That makes kind of puts a pressure on people that something must be done about this. It's been fax sent to us by fax. But fax, you see, is now just substituting for the letter. And so most of the pressure is phony. It is actually phony pressure that we've built up for ourselves. So in our marriage, we haven't got to work by fax, by some urgent communication between us. There may be a time when we've got to do that, but we shouldn't be communicating under a sense of urgency and pressure. We should be communicating every day, all the time. And that communication should be free and full. And so it should be accessible to each of us. Now, I know some of you live with husbands that you can't stop talking. And some of you live with wives that you can't stop talking. You know, and just because that's the kind of person they are. And some of us live with a partner that somehow you've got great difficulty in making free flow of speech. Not because the person doesn't want to communicate. He or she doesn't find it easy so to do. They are taciturn people, people who just keep things to themselves. And if you ask them a question, they'll say yes. And or no. But not sort of volunteer things, freely flowing. Now, if you're that kind of person, you've got to work on that. You have to work on it, because that's no way of communicating to a partner. You're actually, what you're asking when you get married is, you didn't want a wife, you wanted a mind reader. You know? That's what you needed. Now, and that's too much to ask. We can't always read each other's minds. So, the reason I say this is that I am that type of person that could very well get on with a very limited conversation. You mightn't think so with the way that I've got to speak. But I am, like, I can get on very well without a lot of talk. Now, and that's no good, you see. Just so happens that I'm a wife that speaks her mind. And says it straight away. So I know exactly where I stand. Exactly where I stand and where she stands. And that's great. And I depend on it. But that's cultivated in me now over a period of time. Response. There aren't many occasions where Jesus did not answer questions. There is one. There's one occasion where he made it extremely difficult for somebody. You remember when it was the occasion of the Syrophoenician woman? She came along and asked for help for her daughter. And you've got to piece the records in the Gospels, put them all together. And the first thing he did was not to answer her at all. No answer. Never said a word to her, first of all. Until she then kept on pressing her case. Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on my daughter. Until then, the apostles then said, Lord, just send her away. She's a pest. So Jesus then made it even harder for her, because he did say something to her. He said, I'm not sent to you. I'm sent the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And she didn't bridle at that and say, well, that's a nasty answer to give to me. She just pleaded. And then he said the next thing to her, which was, and all the time he was bringing out her faith. He didn't want to make it hard, he was bringing out her faith. So the next thing, you remember, that he said to her is, it isn't right, you know. It can't be right to take the children's bread and give it to dogs. And she didn't say, are you calling me a dog? She went the opposite way altogether and said, I know that, Lord. I'm not asking for their bread. I'm just asking for, like the little dog in the house we've been in for the last couple of days, that comes and eats the crumbs that you drop. That's all I want. He said, woman, great is thy faith. Go, he said, your daughter's healed. Now, he hadn't been to see the daughter. And the woman had seen nothing at all. Nothing at all. All she'd done was to hear what he said, and she believed it. Until he created a relationship of faith. Now, in our marriage, we try not to have to go through those processes. One, because we're not the Lord Jesus Christ. And two, because we can't put our partner through that kind of drill. Because, one, we haven't the right to do. And two, it might not produce those results. So, communication. And by communication, husbands, I mean communication. About everything. You know, you come home from wherever it is you work, you're in sales or in an office or you've got a hard manual job. When you get in, then your wife says, the paint scratched on the kitchen door, John. You say, paint is scratched on the kitchen door? I've just been out working all day long and you come in and tell me the paint is scratched on the kitchen door? In other words, it can drive you up the wall. Now, in actual fact, you see, what is happening is that there is a level of communication here that husbands have got to learn. We regard these as superficialities. They think, no, don't have paint on the kitchen door. I've been doing important things all day. Which is part of the kind of subterfuge that men use, as though the things we do are important, things you do aren't important. You know? But you want your dinner on the table. That's important. Now, but the person who produces that is the person who asks about the paint on the kitchen door. God has made woman in this particular way. One, she is curious. Eternally curious. Alright? So, somebody handed me a little package within the last 20 minutes, you see. I haven't opened it. I've just put it on Sister Vanessa's bed. It's addressed to both of us. I haven't opened it. Almost certainly, if it had gone to her, she would have opened it because she would have been curious as to what was inside. Now, and not because she wanted to do it without me there. As a matter of fact, that last comment is probably a bit unjust because she probably would have waited now because we wait for each other. But that takes time to cultivate, doesn't it? But this nature, this curiosity of womanhood, the paint scratched on the kitchen door, isn't just about paint. It's about her awareness of home. Her total awareness of home. You never notice the kitchen door. But she has this awareness, and this awareness has been given to her by God because when she has children, she's got to be aware 24 hours a day of all the risks and dangers within the home. She's got to be aware. God's given her this gift. Right, so she will exercise it always, and it's not to be suppressed. Don't tell me about it. It's the wrong thing to do, because it may well be when you have children. I know quite a number of them, most of you have children here. In actual fact, that if she neglected her curiosity, the child might be injured. So, just remember that our supposed men superiority of our thinking is all bunkum. It is just part of the illusion that we've created in our world. I've been taking important decisions all day, don't you know that? One of the decisions I had to take today, well, it was about $50,000. I only had 10 seconds to answer on it. Now it all sounds extremely important, doesn't it? your wife's made a decision as to whether you're going to have saffron rice or something else, you think. Oh, no, come off it, you know. Whatever you decide, it'll be all right until you get it and it isn't right. So then, we just got to learn that there has to be communication. Your wife is entitled to know how your day has gone. Where you've been, who you've spoken to, what you've done. She's entitled to know that, as you're entitled to know what she has done. to whom she's spoken, and so on. Not putting a check over each other, but if you have this freedom, then you won't fall into the trap that you have spoken to somebody, you don't have to say you've spoken to him or to her. Because when you have free communication, then you say, as a matter of fact, Jane rang up today. Why did Jane ring? And now, if you're honest people, then you explain about Jane, right? Why should she ring you today, and so on. Now, and that communication is so valuable. It removes so many problems. You know, there are people that have communications that are clandestine communications that go on between two people that shouldn't be going on. If you have freedom, total freedom of communication as partners, you lessen the risk of that a great deal. And what is more, you build up the confidence that exists between you. So that finally you know each other's minds. Very frequently, we don't have to speak to each other when one of us makes a decision on behalf of both of us, for the simple reason that we know what the decision will be. We've still got to know each other that finally that's what we do. The other thing that we learn to do is that the input into marriage is not of, as we were talking about this morning, my rights in this marriage. I've been out all day. I left here at 6:30 this morning. It's 6:45 now, and you say my meal is not ready for another half hour. Is that what you're saying? Now this is insisting on our rights. Right? We've got rights. Instead of which the answer is, do you need a hand? Is there anything I can do? We haven't checked on why it's not been our late. We just feel that that's something we can do. I'm taking the position from the man's point of view, but it's easier to explain how the problems arise. Now, so what we have to learn is this 1 Corinthians 13 response. And that is that I've got to give the maximum help that I can in this marriage, because I want the marriage to succeed. I do not want it to break down, and I'm not going to contribute to its breakdown by insisting on some way to the pain of my partner, the humiliation of my partner. So you can't get a dinner to time, eh? How do you get another trainee then? And in no time you can pull a marriage to pieces. All I know is that in the early days, if I'd said that, and in extremely good humour, and we didn't eat this at the time, but I can imagine very well what Sister Bunny would have done. She would have picked up the lasagna and tipped it on my head. Not out of any kind of anger, or she doesn't have that, you see, or of spite. But that would take all the seriousness out of the situation whilst it dripped down my face and onto my collar. And I would learn that you don't do that kind of thing. You don't. It's too much of a waste of the sun here. That's the trouble. But so here I'm taking what are humorous situations, which we all know very well. My Sister Bernice has done that to me, but not in that way. Out of sheer love, one day, you know, the paper in which the fish had been wrapped that she cooked for the meal, she rubbed into my hair. I had hair then. Right? She rubbed it into my hair. And that was just love. You may think that's a strange way of showing that. Well, it's a fishy business, love. However, you see, you create a marvellous understanding. May I just say, just in passing, that many serious situations can be totally defused by a touch of humour. Changes the situation altogether. Bernice's cousin, they haven't been married very long, when she cooked an apple pie. Well, and this is quite a while ago, when we had open fires in Britain. In other words, you had a coal fire, you see. And that's how the house was warmed, and where you sat in front of the fire, which was quite delightful. However, she cooked this apple pie and it was still white. It had got no touch of brown or no invitingness in the top.
you see.
So she didn't know what to do now, so she took the apple pie and she held it in front of the fire, like toast, you see, she was trying to attack. Well, this was all right, you know, and the idea was quite good, until the pie slipped off the plate into the coal ashes down below. Well, now, this was a moment when the husband was waiting for his pie, could have been extremely angry, instead of which he got a little stool, and he stood in the corner, and he sang, "God Bless Our Apple Pie," to the tune of "God Bless the Queen." And, well, that diffused the situation. So, and probably he ate some of the pie, I imagine. But the fact is that there are ways in which you can hype up a potential difficult situation by a wrong word, a wrong look, or where you are, what you do, or you can, in fact, sort of gear it right down so that finally you don't have a problem. Problems are better solved before they happen than when they happen. And we're all aware of this. You know, once you've had a stand-up fight about something, you've got a lot of things, I don't mean physically, though I know in some cases that's what it comes to. Once you've had that, you've got a lot of repair to do. A lot of repair. You've lost your dignity, you've lost your temper, you haven't managed to control yourself. How on earth are you going to put the situation right? Now, and so, we have to remember in our marriage that we are conscientious objectors. We're not conscientious objectors at wartime, we're conscientious objectors 100% of the time. And therefore, in our relationships, we have not got to repay what we think is evil, but evil with good. That's what we've got to do. And once we've learned the art of doing that, you will find that your marriage will improve by at least 90%. If you're in a marriage that has tensions to it. The things that I described in 1 Corinthians 13, you just think about them and about the situations where these things would apply. Alright, so you come into the house and it's pretty clear that the air is frigid. For whatever reason it is, something you said before you left the house perhaps, or something that you should have done and haven't done, quite apart from what's happened to the partner who's remained in the house. Just go through 1 Corinthians 13 and have a look at the things you could apply right away, every day in your marriage. Every day in your marriage. For example, I never leave the table without saying thank you to my wife for the meal. Never leave the table. Do you do that? Or do you just take it for granted? And I don't say it in a perfunctory way either. In fact, as we've been doing here, I might take up the china from the first course, take it out into the kitchen, and on my way I will kiss her for the first course. The second course tastes so much better. But that, you see, there is something about it. And I'm sorry to quote our example, and it makes Sister Bates cringe at times, but I do it so that, it exposes us. And it's easier to expose us than it is to try to expose other people or to create, as I can, mythical situations. I can do those easily enough. But when I give you real-life situations, you then discover that the children do the same. And your grandchildren do the same. It's amazing. The habit soon grows. Until the grandchildren get up and say, "Could we take these out?" And they take them out and say thank you on the way. Now, so you have a relationship that builds up and it spreads to other people. So solving problems, the real way to solve problems is to stop them happening. That's the real way, to stop them happening. I know they will happen from time to time. We'll have to look at it as just how we deal with them. But just glance for a moment, if you've got 1 Corinthians 13 on your knee, just glance at them for a second or two and see whether a situation in which you have been, in your own marriage, could have been removed. For example, what about verse 5? And next, that the little phrase that's next to the end of that sentence. That love is not easily provoked. All right? practice it. You'll have opportunities galore to practice it, because there are always adverse circumstances at work, in the street, in the shop. There are always adverse circumstances, and from time to time within marriage. You see, the principles that we're applying to marriage apply to life as a whole. You can do exactly the same thing with a checkout girl at the supermarket. I've been here 3 minutes, do you know? All I wanted was just these two things. And there you are, talking to somebody. In other words, you can soon hype up any situation you like. Now, if you're in the habit of doing it, you do it everywhere. You do it with another driver on the road. You let him know. Somebody you never met before, you let him know. You don't like him. Now, so if we just practice the things that are here, and you know how Bob Lloyd has these little verses he puts in those pills. I find the pill itself hard to digest, but the thing inside is all right. just take these things. As I mentioned to one or two of you before, I pray this chapter every day. Do come in. And so I pray this chapter every day. This is my prayer, the last thing at night, that tomorrow I will live according to this chapter and bring forth the fruit of the Spirit. Now, you can't do it unless you pray about it, because these are not natural things, are they? They're not natural things. They are unnatural things, which you make into supernatural things by saying, I'm going to do that. You cut gossip dead by thinketh no evil. So across your table at home, you don't trade in gossip. I know, as a married couple, that we have the intimacies of conversation, and from time to time we have to mention people for the safeguard of our own situation. But there are times when we just relish the idea that somebody's got into trouble, you know. Heard about, you know, and your ear gets big, you say, what? Do tell me. You know, then you hear about it. Not maybe. But she had it coming to her. And since the situations are exactly what we understand, that's what happens. Instead of, well, I'm sorry about that. That must be bad. Then's the time to pray about it. For her. And you don't just pray for the people you like and the people you love, you pray for the people you don't like and don't love, because that's what God's done in his salvation. We were unlovely and he loved us. We were not likable people at all. And therefore what we're doing in our marriage and in life is to do what God has done to us. And if we don't do it, we don't believe that God did it. We do not believe in the atonement, in what it achieved for us. And we're in danger then of losing the value of the atonement in ourselves and in our own marriage. So just have a look at this little list of things. Pick out the ones that you find hardest to do and pray about them specifically. That's what I do. There are certain things, whatever yours are, I don't know. I mean, all of us are troubled by pride, so you can even have a look at that love is not puffed up. But because everybody is proud to a certain degree. But there are certain aspects of our own personal lives where you know, that's my weak spot. Well, pray about it, that you don't want to do that. And if you are quick in your replies in your marriage, and you say hurtful things, then pray about it and tell God you don't want to do it. That's what you've got to do. Tell God, I do not want to do this, Lord. And I'm sorry that I do it. Help me to practice love. So don't treat this chapter as a trivial chapter. When I spoke at the Easter gathering, it's 18 months ago, I suppose, now, when I spoke, I actually used this chapter. Only because I believe this chapter is dynamite. Absolute dynamite. I don't know any other passage of Scripture that has got in it the power that this chapter has. Because, you know, sometimes there are people who say, no, I wouldn't give an exhortation on love if I were you. It's so wishy-washy, you'd say, oh, it's got no substance to it, you see. You say, well, what do you want then? Well, give us some good Bible food, give us that. And give us a bit of exposition, a bit of exhortation on Bible food, you see. Now, that sounds all very good, and it's all phony.
The whole thing is phony. The verses that were and were beautifully read by Mark. Look, just have a look at verse 2 and just see what it says. It says, and though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and have all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains. Now how's that for Bible exposition and Bible knowledge, eh? Well, it's got everything in it. And then it says, and have not charity, I have nothing. Not something, I'm part way there, I have absolutely nothing. That's what it says. In other words, what the chapter is telling us is that love, in its true meaning, precedes everything else. And so it does in marriage. Not the kind of dreamy kind of love life that we all have, the romantic kind of love that we all have, and still have in ourselves. It's going to be a full moon tomorrow night on the boat. All right. Well, you know how that is. We all understand. That's great. The moon hath raised her lamp above to light the way to thee, my love. Shakespeare. All right, so he knew, and we all understand it, and it's good, and you get kind of feelings down your back. When especially there's a bit of the right kind of music. The right kind of music, you know. And I don't quite know what the right kind of music is now, but these days especially. But I find some of these noises a bit difficult. But especially, I don't understand it, but when the only thing you can hear is but that wouldn't be so bad if it stopped. It doesn't stop, it goes on. I haven't done everything else, you know, it's just like it's painful. At least for the rest of us, but as opposed to other people, it means something. But that's romance, and we all have it, and we've got, from time to time, there is a delight in expressing it. It isn't a practical kind of love. I mean, the practical kind of love, this is a quick change of subject, is Jesus going to Calvary. Beareth all things. Believeth all things. And so we understand now that love is what made Calvary possible. God's love and Christ's love for God made it possible. Now we express that in this closest of relationships that we have, which is marriage. And therefore we've got to practice the atonement in marriage. So do you want to lose your husband? Do you want to lose your wife? And the answer is no, Lord, no, Lord. Well then do all that you can, like I did, as my son did, in order to redeem, to recover, to make possible reconciliation, not make it harder. I mean, there's no point when a situation goes wrong in not talking, is there? You know, that was Ahab, turned his face to the wall, you know, that was it. Peevish, poutish man that he was. Eagle, however. But perhaps your method, my method, might be that we become silent. Now, our partner knows that, but now our partner, in some way, has got to do something about the situation. You know, to prise our mouth open in some way, in order to get a sound out of it. Now, may I just say, that, and we have this in our opening prayer, and thank you for that opening prayer, because it had in it the two things that are the key elements. Now, I know that all of you do not do the daily reading. I know that because there is no group of brethren and sisters where everybody does the daily readings. Now, you may think it's a bind, it's a chore, it's a kind of duty. Forget all that. The fact is, it isn't that at all. It is a means whereby God instructs our hearts and our minds to make our marriage work and to make everything else work. We went through Naaman today and we saw how in that situation, at the end, he came right. I've prepared the exhortation tomorrow, but I was crossing over in my mind whether to take the little maid and talk about her to you, because I've got a great affection for that girl, and she worked wonders. Marvellous things she did. But she's not a parent right away. She's got no name. There she is. Now, in marriage, you see, you can transform marriage by yourself
being the first to say, I'm sorry, George. Now, it may not be your fault, primarily. We don't know that. It's like a car accident. You don't know whose fault it is. You may think, well, I was across the white line or whatever it is. But you don't know whether the chap's on drugs. And therefore, the insurance company says, don't you make any admission of guilt. That's for their own purposes. But the fact is, you see, we don't know. Therefore, it's better in our marriage situation, which isn't an insurance situation, a litigious and law situation. It's on another situation altogether. It's grace. And grace says, I am sorry. Now, the response you will get to that most frequently is, it wasn't your fault. Now you're over the hurdles. You've cleared the hurdles, and you've been each other's arms in no time. And I'm glad that it is so. And you're not just picking up the pieces of a broken situation. So just learn how to be humble in these situations. You know, it's easy to say, that's the third time you've done that this week. Well, it may be the third time you've done that this week, but that's not solely the problem, is it? If it isn't third time, then if you have communication, then gradually, by love and mutual understanding, you remove these possibilities, not by pointing them out and underlining them, and then screwing on them to the pain of your partner. Not at all. You do it by the positive things that ensure that won't happen, or will happen less frequently. You've got your weaknesses. He or she has his or hers. And we know that. Now don't play on them, because all that will happen is you will aggravate the situation. So, the Word of God and prayer. Now, I don't know whether you pray together every day. Together, I mean, every day. We end our prayers together, as we did last night, with a prayer together. You want to ask me the question, well, who voices the prayer? Well, I voice it. Not because I take charge of it, but that's how both of us want it to be. Each of us wants it to be, Sister Bernice included. And that prayer goes through all the things of the day. So yesterday, it was our thanks for being here, arriving safely, thanks for all of us meeting, asking for a blessing on those who were still travelling, then asking for a blessing on today, and then our own family, and our own ecclesia, those in need in our own ecclesia, and those in need in other parts of the world that you think about and you know, and so that your prayer extends like the love of God extends. Now, if you have a prayer together each day, you can never carry through the prayer the argument that you may have had. It won't go through prayer. It can't go through. It stops at prayer. That's where it stops. It is a solution. Otherwise, you're going to be hypocritical. And you can be hypocritical about it and pretend it's got it, it stops, but you're going to bring it up again next day. In actual fact, with this prayer at the end of each day, together, you'll discover that it is extremely useful. Now, if you're shy about it, you know, if you're, for example, the kind of husband that finds that difficult to do, there are ways in which you can do it. And one of the ways is to say, well, let's have a prayer, and let's take a psalm and read it aloud to God. You see, all the psalms are prayer. Prayer in distress, prayer in every kind of pain, every kind of loss, prayer that says to God in actual words, and God has inspired them, Lord, why are you so far away? It's actually in the prayer. That's what the man felt. And God, by inspiration, caused that to be written to know that he understands about that. But you know the little thing that's you see on these boards outside churches and chapels. If God feels far away, who moved? We're the ones who moved. Or circumstances around us seem to have moved God away. God hasn't moved away at all. May I just say this thing, in just a passing. God has no problems. God hasn't got any problem. He's not looking for solutions to problems. He has the answers to all of them. Now, being human, we have problems without answers. If we believe that God's got the answers, let's go to him. The answer we get may not be the answer that we think we ought to have sometimes, you know? And so it is sometimes in circumstances where we've geared everything up just right, that we ought to be leaving at 3 o'clock. And then we shall have to do whatever it is a little bit later on, and
for some reason things get held up and we don't get away till 3:20.
You know, we might be fuming, why haven't we got away? We just get to the highway and discover we can't get on it. The accident happened 10 minutes ago. We'd have been there. No, God knows that. So let's not imagine that we've got all the answers to the problems, because we haven't. And we're not telling God, and we're not asking God to change his mind. We can't change the will of God. In fact, we wouldn't want to change the will of God. Because then, we learn to speak to God together. When we have our prayer at the end of the day, each of us still has our own separate prayer. We need that. And, in fact, and you might think this is a very strange thing, you might think it's irreverent to do it. Nevertheless, this is how I end each day. I fall asleep praying. In other words, I just go on praying until I fall asleep. Now, I find that helpful. You might find it, you might say to yourself, I don't like that. I think every prayer ought to be finished and done properly. Well, that's your conscience on this matter. This is mine. That's how it stops the mind wandering. And what is more, when you go to sleep, then the last thing you had on your mind was prayer. It was the very last thing. You were actually in touch with God and you fell asleep. Now, that does affect the way you rest, and perhaps the thoughts we have whilst we're asleep. Because I think they too can be affected by, well, they obviously are affected by the way we lead our daily lives. So make prayer and the Word of God just two of the great stays of Scripture. The other thing is, if you have problems, don't stay away from the meeting. Right? You know, think, well, I can't go to the meeting after this. Just say, we're going to the meeting, please, and go. You will discover then that the situation you're in is larger than your own domestic situation. And consequently, you will get an injection, an infusion of spiritual blood from the rest of the people who are there. Now, all these are practical things to do when the situation is tense. And you can learn how really so to quieten and cool down the situation that gradually the thing just disappears altogether. If you get into a desperate situation because you've driven yourselves into a corner and the things I've spoken don't seem to be practical things, we've got to have this out, you know, and you determine that's what you're going to do. Well, you're on a dangerous road when you say that, we're going to have this out. Because we have to remember this, that at the judgment seat, we should be judged by the standards that we use in our marriage. You've got to remember that. God won't be more gracious than we have been in our marriage. Because we are setting the tone of the day of judgment. That's what the Scripture says. Forgive as we have forgiven. And if we don't forgive, then we're going to be in trouble at the judgment seat. And that's why our marriages are not just temporal things, they're also things to do with eternity. And as I said in the very first talk, I think it was the first talk, since we're seeking each other's salvation, then let's get down to it. Not having this thing out because we've decided together that we're going to put the problem on that side of the table and ourselves on this side. There may be problems that have got to be talked through. Let me just give a situation, right? Let's just take the mother-in-law situation, right? Now, this is not easy, and I've had to do this on one occasion when I took a wedding where the bride's mother was there, a very interfering, gracious lady, all right, who didn't think she was interfering, really, but she took charge of everything. Every single thing she would take charge of in her daughter's life. She happened to be widowed, and consequently she hadn't got a husband there, but she took charge. And I actually said during the marriage service, see, in our marriage services, the bride and the groom don't stand when it comes to the words of exhortation. You stand here, do you? Yeah. I find this extremely strange. I'll tell you why I find it strange. First of all, because there's a kind of caucus on the platform. You know, or everybody there that's on the platform are all sort of knit together.
You sometimes can see the brother who's carrying out the marriage service, sometimes you can't. His head keeps bobbing up from behind. But the whole thing, you see, is an artificial situation. So when it comes to the part of talking, then, you know, the bride's standing, she says, well, I hope this doesn't last much longer, because I can't bear these shoes. Well, the best thing is just to sit down. And you'll find that helpful. Because I don't know whether the words that you have in weddings are actual practical words. If I take a wedding, I don't give holy words, that kind of thing, you know, so that the whole thing is like syrup being poured on everything. Maple syrup. Not like that at all. But the thing is practical. And so, that's the words I would say would be practical words for the groom, the bride, the two together, and everybody around them. Well, on this occasion, I had to say this to the mother. It just so happens that one or two here have got the same name, so I won't use it. But I had to say to her, you'll have to let your daughter go into the marriage. You see? Let her go. We've got to learn that lesson of let go. Because the daughter has got to come into the marriage and to cleave unto her husband. That was the verse we had in Genesis, wasn't it? Cleave unto your husband. That situation has got to obtain. Now these mothers, this is a mother in this case, father, as far as the groom was concerned, it was mother-in-law. She was on the telephone always, you know. This isn't what she said, but this is the kind of situation. A telephone ring, you pick it up. Yeah? Hello, mother. Yeah? No. Not tonight, we don't have any steak. What do you say? You wouldn't have steak today. I see. What would you think you ought to have then? Well, I always used to give Frank, and now she goes into this thing, and she rings up tomorrow and says, what are you having? You know. In other words, she's running the menu for everything. You know, and then she says, what dress have you got on? You say, what dress I've got on? I've got the cream one, you know, with the flowers around the collar. What, at dinner? You oughtn't have that. You know the one I bought you. Why don't you wear that? In other words, you've got total interference. And there's that sort of George sitting down waiting for his dinner, you see. And, well, I spoke during this wedding service, and I spoke very clearly about letting your daughter go. She didn't let the daughter go, and the marriage is broke. Now, if you are experiencing a situation like that, then something has to be done, hasn't it? I know that it's not easy to do it, because this dear sister, she didn't know she was interfering. She didn't think that. She thought this was love. You see, she'd always done this with her daughter at home, and the daughter was a great girl. You know, and the wedding was a kind of super wedding. But then it just crumbles into ashes, you see. And they're not together. And, you know, well, they may come together, but no sign of it at the present time. This is all so difficult. We've got to learn, husbands, we've got to learn to make sure that our wife is free, if we can, all right? I know there are some mothers who will ring up more frequently than others, but if they take hold of the situation, and that the decisions that we too should make are now being made by her, then we're losing out, and we've got to make it plain that that's not right. And so it may be necessary for someone to say to his mother, her mother, personally, saying, look, thanks for your help, but George and I are married now, you know, Mother, and we make our own decisions. We might be glad of your advice from time to time, but we shall make our own decisions. That's how it's going to be. Now, these are hard things to have to say, but sometimes it is necessary to say it, all right? Because the situation I've spoken about isn't about one particular marriage. It's about several, okay? So, by the way, stop now. Well, I have just two people talking together, so I think it's about time that I stopped it. Because that's what they think, it's time you stopped, Harry. So I'm stopping. Is that okay? Yes. Thank you. Right. Lots of other things one could say, but you had enough. We've had enough. Is that right?